Today's episode is sponsored by Audible, and today's novel, 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami, is available through Audible.com's audiobook library. A novel podcast listeners can get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'm joined tonight by our good friends Julie and Tanya. Tonight we're discussing 1Q84. 1Q84 is a dystopian novel written by Japanese writer Haruki Murakami, and it was first published in three volumes in Japan in 2009 and 10, released in the US and the UK 2 years later. It tells the story of two characters who know each other, but haven't been in contact since childhood. Masami Aomame and Tengo Kawana attempt to reunite with each other in a world that becomes increasingly surreal and supernatural. A fair warning to all our audience members, there will be spoilers in this episode, so if you have not yet finished reading the book, I suggest you do that before you continue to listen. We'll give away any points of the plot that we feel like need to be given away for a good discussion. So as we were starting this conversation, as we were just starting this call, we were discussing the great length of this book and what it would take to translate such a volume. Julie, you want to continue your thoughts on that? Because obviously this is quite the doorstopper.
Yeah, you know, I think that sometimes, you know, if I were someone that was trying to translate, say, a mystery with action and facts and clues and things like that, it would be one thing, right? But this book, words were just very artful and so much, you know, obviously very in-depth character development and painting pictures and things like that. And so I just really, I wish that I could read Japanese so that I could read the Japanese version and see how it stands up, because I just can't imagine that task of translation. I don't know. I couldn't stop thinking about it the entire time because of just the words that they chose. And how do you know that you're doing the author true? I don't know.
Yeah, and considering that a lot of the work is a work of fantasy, I've always been intrigued by, does that make it harder or easier?
Yes.
I mean, is it easier to create something out of thin air for the little people or the air chrysalis, or does that make it harder?
Right.
I don't know. Tanya, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking the exact same thing that Julie was throughout. I wonder what Haruki Murakami himself thinks of the translation. I think, you know, cultural nuances. I think there was something about repetition throughout the book. Repeating a lot. And I'm not sure, you know, he does a good job of explaining sort of Japanese culture and their way of speech, you know, and interactions with each other. But I don't know that in English it read the same way or came across as polite as it would in Japanese culture. It just felt repetitive. It just felt too much. Like, well, you said this already, and is that really what you were trying to say, or does it have something to do with this sort of polite interaction culture? I don't know. But I definitely thought about it throughout as well, and definitely felt the same, that I wish I could read Japanese, because I feel like the book would give me a different, I'd feel different about what I was reading.
Yeah, that's such a great point that you bring in talking about culture, because Japanese culture is obviously so different from ours, especially in terms of like what is considered bold in Japanese culture is, you know, not at all bold in American culture. Right. You know what I mean? So that's and you're right. Lots of repetition. Very interesting. What did you think about that, Russ?
I noticed the same thing, the repetition.
Yeah.
Now, you'd also mentioned, you know, repetition and the idea of a parallel world. From the very outset, you see, you're introduced to Aomame, and she's stuck on the highway, and this kind of an interesting character of a taxi driver is telling her, well, there's a way to get where you need to go by climbing down this access ladder. But I should have written down exactly what he said. I don't remember precisely what it was, but it was something to the effect of, sometimes when you make strange choices like this, it can have a ripple effect in ways that you wouldn't even know. So from the very outset, you're kind of hinted at something strange is happening.
Oh, was it when he said that things aren't always as they seem, or
something to that effect? Yes. And it made me think almost immediately of the Mandela effect. Which, are you guys familiar with the Mandela effect?
I just heard about recently on a very recent car ride, which I didn't know about before.
Julie, are you familiar with the Mandela effect?
No, do tell.
So the idea, in a nutshell, is that when there's general consensus over the way a certain thing is, and then all of a sudden it's exposed to be either untrue or misinterpreted. It's called the Mandela effect because when Nelson Mandela actually died, there was a huge group of people who had kind of had the thought, wait a minute, I thought he died 15 years ago in prison or something to that effect. Another popular one is the Berenstain Bears. Of course, anybody in our age grew up, or age group grew up reading Berenstain Bears books and probably remember now of Berenstain Bears. But when you go to actually read the Berenstain Bears, it's spelled Berenstain, S-T-A-I-N, and people don't believe it. So they are thinking of this as evidence that there could be a parallel world, or there's a glitch in the Matrix or something like that. And that got me thinking, Aomami didn't remember Japanese police officers carrying automatic pistols. She remembers them carrying revolvers. And from that point on, I thought, this is very reminiscent of, this isn't the way I remember things.
Well, it's nice to get that sort of visual or imagery around, you know, the Mandela effect and IQ or 1Q84, because if I'm being honest, I didn't get this, the significance of the parallel world, or I guess I had too many questions. Like, why is this not affecting everybody? I'm not sure that was answered to my satisfaction anyway. And anyway, we'll get to the end, and that's a whole other bag of worms with the ending, because I didn't get there. I didn't get it. But yeah, just, you know, why isn't everybody experiencing things the same way? And it just didn't seem consistent. I don't know. Maybe that was just me.
I felt like, especially when you get to the end, that a lot of the unanswered questions were just that. They were unanswered in the way to give it. It's up to the reader to decide what had happened. A few things like, what happened to Ayumi? What happened to her?
And why did it happen?
Or what exactly happened? Yes. Or what exactly happened to...
I totally thought that... Sorry. For Ayumi? Probably butchering that. I assumed that that was the little people working through... You know, they don't do things, but they work through others to do things.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed that because, you know, that she was... They said they'll get to you through your loved ones or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But Ayumi's death didn't necessarily change any of Aomami's actions or the course of the actions that she was taking. It seemed
true,
to just
but
be,
they were trying to hurt her, right? They were trying to make her back down, right? But you're right, it didn't change her course. That's interesting.
But then again, there wasn't really anything that changed her course. So to give a little backstory on the plot, we have Aomami, who has been hired by the Dowager to end the lives of disreputable people. And she takes out a hit on a very, very influential person, the leader of the religious cult Sakigake. And on going in to take out this leader, they find themselves in a hotel room all by themselves. And that's when Aomami realizes that this guy knows that she's there to kill him. And not only that, he wants her to kill him. And he makes a bit of a prophecy at this point, and this is when you kind of see Aomami might have been thinking about him all this time, but this is when the reader kind of realizes that, oh, Aomami has been thinking about this other guy that she's known since, second grade, but hasn't seen since then, Tengo Kawana. And you remember that leader makes that prophecy, something to the effect of, you have to give up your life, or he will be giving up his life. You guys remember that?
Right.
I totally thought one of them. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No. Yeah. That they couldn't meet in this parallel universe, this mm-hmm. other sphere, yeah, that they couldn't meet. One would have to give up the life for the other. Well, one would have to die or the other. Either way, they would never cross paths, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And if
I thought
Almame was not... Go ahead.
I thought the entire time that prophecy would come true. I was so happy that was not the case, because I really thought this was going to be a, you know, Romeo and Juliet thing, and one of them was going to die, and, you know.
And so that was my question, is that how is it that that's not the case? What is the significance of this prophecy not coming true? And not only that, I'd mentioned some other loose ends. The other big one for me was, in the end, we have the little people appearing from a new portal, and they begin to build a new air chrysalis, and then we never see them again. What were they doing? And does that have anything to do with Tengo and Almame exiting this world of 1Q84, assumingly returning to 1984?
And, you know, honestly, I disagree with Julie, or I'm on the other end of the spectrum, in that I wish the prophecy had come true. I wish that they would not have met. I feel like I would have had a bit more peace with the flow and sort of what the whole purpose of the little people and all the pain that, you know, these kids had to go through, or Eriko Fukada, probably butchering that. I feel like things would have made a little bit more sense if it ended up not being this love story, which, again, huge spoiler. There would have been a little bit more rhyme and reason to why all the pain and why all the tension, and I don't know, it would have just made more sense to me if they had, in fact, stayed true to that prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would have made the book make more sense, because I agree with that. It would have made the book make more sense. Like you said, that's how the entire flow was going, was that, you know, everything that Leader and that Eriko Fukairi. I should have reminded myself, I should have read up a little bit before this on the character names. But anyway.
The narrator in the audiobook pronounced it Fukairi.
Fukairi. Okay, that's good. But everything that all of those characters, like you said, that's a good point. The flow of it, everything that all of those characters were kind of striving for, and it all made sense, and it would have made a lot more sense if that would have been carried through. I agree. But I'm still happy it didn't, because I do like a happy ending. I do like a happy ending. But I'm a sucker like that, I realize that.
And that's fine. The question is, do you believe, really, truly believe that it was a happy ending? They go to this other world, and there's hints that it's not their own world. And then, of course, you have the little people building this new air chrysalis for purposes unknown. Do you think that they've escaped? I mean, I guess that must be what you feel like in your heart, but upon reconsideration, you still feel that way. Okay.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because they're in their own world now. They're in their own world now. And they don't care about anything else, because they got what they wanted and they're happy.
Okay.
I don't know if I do. I don't. I didn't get that feeling. I definitely got the feeling that, not that they would have to look over their shoulder, but, I mean, the little people, to me, are ever present. And I think that,
they're not going away.
Yeah, I don't know that they're going away. And again, I think there was, at some point in the book, they mentioned that, you know, the little people are not, the term they used was a really good one, but that they're not necessarily evil or good. They go with circumstance and they react to, you know, things around them. It was explained much better in the book. But, you know, I think that just because they're in 1984 and maybe, you know, friends aren't dying and they don't have to hide out in, you know, random places, that doesn't mean that the little people aren't there and looking and making sure that, you know, their existence is not being exposed, and by there I mean the existence of the little people. But kind of on a parallel note, Tengo seemed to be thriving quite a bit in 1Q84, I feel like he finally understood himself better. I feel like, you know, with his writing, things were working out for him. He found, you know, his love in 1Q84. I don't know that 1984 is going to be particularly better. I kind of got this sense that they're going to get back into 1984 and, you know, she'll realize that Tengo is just, you know, some sort of low ambition guy. And, you know, Aomame is a killer. And I don't know that love is going to survive in 1984, whereas it could have in 1Q84. I think I'm just really a pessimist.
That's so true. That's so depressing. Thanks.
Okay, well, now it's my turn to disagree, because that's not the way that I interpreted it at all. I look at Tengo's life, and he's living in a crummy apartment, and one of his primary focuses is food, but how often is the food that he's eating described as tasteless? Meeting all these people and having relationships that kind of don't really go anywhere. And then you look at Aomame, and she's chasing meaningless sexual encounters. She has a job that she's good at but isn't particularly enthralled with. And the whole time there's something kind of pulling at their soul, and you don't know what it is as the reader, and they don't know what it is as characters until they remember each other. And this one chance encounter that seemed to come out of absolutely nowhere, was it ever described why Aomame reached out to grab his hand?
You mean when they were finally in the same place in that playground, or?
No, I mean when they were in school together.
Oh, right.
Because he was nice to her.
And it was never explained, but I think that was the undertone. I think it was, yeah, that he had helped
you're
her.
You're right, because she was a member of the, or her family was a member of that religious organization.
Yep.
It wasn't right. Sakigake, it was the predecessor of Sakigake.
The Witnesses.
Or no, it was the other one.
The Witnesses. Right?
Correct.
Yeah. Society of Witnesses or something.
Yeah.
Right, and you're right. So, and they did have that common thread of being dragged around pavement pounding with their parents.
Right.
But then they were separated, and ever since they've been separated, they've been chasing something, but kind of spinning their wheels. Well, now that they're together, I think that they've lost the shackles that, and maybe this is me being hopeless romantic, I don't know what it is, but I'm going to agree with Julie that I think everything's going to work out just fine, because that's the significance of the story.
I love how this is the kind of book where people can take different things from the ending. Do you know what I mean? It's not cut and dry, and it's, I love when that happens.
Yeah, he definitely left a lot of room for interpretation at the end there, I think.
Yeah.
Now, there's a bit of a theme in this book, this theme of duality, and you see that throughout the entire novel up until the very end. So this one-to-one relationship of Maza and Dota, of Tengo Aomame, you have the two moons, and we see it in a variety of different places. And there's these two forces vying either against each other or spiraling with each other throughout the novel. But then in the end, we're not in 1Q84 or 1984, we're potentially in this whole other world. Did you guys pick up on any other evidence of this duality, and then what do you think was the significance of this theme?
Ooh, I like that. First of all, one thing I will say, I thought for a while that possibly, I'm not completely addressing this, but I thought for a while Fukiri was her, the one that was staying at his apartment, mm-hmm. was her Dota. Because like he said, well, and I think she probably was, right? She didn't have a period, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and some things like that. And she was very dry and kind of emotionless. And so there were a couple of times where I was wondering who all is running around here.
Yes.
You know, and if you have, you know, you're you, and then all of a sudden there's your Dota running around. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's creepy. What's your Dota doing? And do people, you know, but that concept creeped me out quite a bit.
Yeah, I I thought I had a handle on the Mazza Dota stuff, but I, when the young girl, when she left the Dowager, what is her name?
Yes.
You're right, I should have written her name. Tsubasa.
Yes.
Tsubasa, yeah. So when she left, and then, because it was much later on that they then described Mazza and Dota, and I realized that, okay, Tsubasa, that must have been, that was her Dota, for her
right.
to be able to sort of vanish in the night.
Yeah.
You know, that means that was her Mazza calling her home or something like that. I'm still not sure. I'm very clear on the concept, but then that made me, leader's explanations.
No, I got that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Leader's explanations on, for example, you know, the kids, at Sakigake, they lose, you know, sort of emotion, or they become very cut or very dry. That, to me, I understood that as their Dotas. And here, I guess I have a question, because that's what I sort of got from it, that these kids, i.e. Fuka Eri and Tsubasa, being very dry, not having sort of fluent speech, being sort of emotionless, that is indicative that these are their Dotas present, right?
That's what I picked and, up
for. Oh, I didn't even think about that. Maybe that at a certain age, they quit going to school and they send their Dotas.
I don't know. Because why the change? I don't know that they actually did explain why the change all of
right.
a sudden. That
or,
they, you know, start school pretty okay and then
horrible trauma, and then they go inside. And you bring up an interesting
which is,
point.
Which is what
which
I
is
originally
maybe,
thought.
Which is what I thought too. But yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah.
And but then it just puts everything out of in this state of disarray, because I'm like, I thought, you know, Fuka Eri was just her person. And the Mazza is
right.
the original person, and the Dota is the air chrysalis being or entity. So sort of I was thrown for a loop when I started having to regard Fuka Eri as possibly being the Dota instead of her real self. And unless there were two of her walking around and she had access
right.
to both and they were both away from Sakigake, I'm not sure.
Well, and I like how they didn't tell us that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of like that didn't get completely shaken out, and I was still kind of wondering, because a lot of times, like I was saying earlier, I like things to be tied up in those sense, but you know, and sometimes I like for there to be a bit of wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Questions unanswered.
It gives fodder for such things as
right.
podcasts.
Right. But for as far as I'm trying to think of other examples of duality, because that's a great point that I didn't think about while I was reading the book, which is that's absolutely a theme. And I'm trying to think of other examples with that, maybe like with Ushikawa or Komatsu or something like that, but I'm not coming up with anything now. Did you guys think of any other things?
Just thinking about it now, the bodyguards,
mm-hmm.
the short one and the ponytail.
Ponytail and crew cut, was it?
Was it crew cut? Yeah,
Yeah. Buzz cut.
Buzz cut.
That's the one. I knew it started with a B. I can't tell. You know, not sure of the significance, you know, the duality there. But, I mean, they're definitely present throughout and always
yeah.
together. Never, you know, just one.
Yeah.
And the Dowager and her bodyguard.
Tamaru.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Tamaru. Tamaru, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked him. And I liked how they called her the Dowager. I thought that was very interesting. And I have such a visual of her in my head. Like, this is the kind of book that they can never put into a movie because it would crush me and all of the visuals that I have
everything.
In my head.
He
it
did a very
everything.
Good job. He did a very good job of drawing up these characters, I think, in anyone's mind. If we all had to draw what we read, we would probably see the same or very similar looking people. I think he did he's an amazing author. I've read a few of his other books, and he's very good at this sort of character description.
Oh, interesting. Have. So does he have the same style in terms of like repeating things and going off into, you know, tangents? And
he does. He absolutely does, at least from what I've read. And funny thing is, as I was reading one Q84, I had just finished reading one of his other books, The Colorless Tsukuru Tazaki, I think it's called, and thought to myself throughout, I wonder if he used the same translator, because it definitely came off very, very similar. He has, the author has, seems to have knowledge, quite a bit of knowledge on the war that the Japanese had with the Soviets in Manchuria. That comes up quite a bit in like three of his other novels, and seem true. I will admit that I didn't do the research to find out what elements of those were true, but he definitely shows that, you know, exhibits that knowledge throughout. Definitely with the repetitions, that comes up quite a lot. But the point I'm trying to make with the character description is how he ingrains that into your mind. Like, you can't possibly, because of this repetition, you cannot forget that Tengo is this, you know, big, you know, bear-like, you know, person. Aomame and her, you know, physical deformities, as she would say that they are, you know, one breast being larger than the other and one ear being bigger than the other. And you don't forget these things. And it definitely creates a very vivid visual, I think.
Hmm. He also has this technique that I really appreciated, where he introduces a character. And of course, you get very familiar with them, and repetition, you come to know who they are. But then at some point in time, another character will come across somebody that neither of you know, a mysterious figure or, you know, person in a bar or something to that effect. And then slowly over time, you'll come to unveil aspects of this mysterious figure and come to realize, oh, wait a minute, I do know who this person is. And it seems like the author does a really good job of making you realize who this person is, going to, oh, that's Tamura come to kill, what was his name, Ushikawa. Okay, so now Tamura has come to kill Ushikawa. Oh, wait a minute, now he's using Tamura's name, almost immediately after I realized who it was. And he did that several times throughout the novel, and I felt that was really a really neat hook, and it did kind of make me go, suck me into the book very well.
Yeah, I completely agree. Oh, that's interesting. So you definitely, you have read several of his books, obviously, then you are a fan.
I don't know that I would call myself a fan.
a glutton for punishment?
I think so. I don't know if it's been very clear, but I was not a huge fan of this book. I had too many criticisms of it by the end of it. Besides, you know, we're working with a benchmark of he's an amazing author. He's an amazing user of words to convey stories. That's sort of the benchmark, and we're not going to go below that. But sort of looking above, I don't know that I'm a huge fan. But I don't like to dismiss any author, and I read authors. I like to read authors. So, you know, I don't want to dismiss any author based on one or two or three books. I sort of give it a chance and take it from there. So I think 1Q84 was probably, that's like my third chance or third or fourth with him. And unfortunately, the opinion hasn't changed too much. I always end his books wanting a little. Just asking too many questions, and I don't like that.
Oh, that's so interesting. I think it's so interesting to hear Tanya's perspective, and that's very, and I love how mine's totally different. And it makes me want completely like side discussion with you on other books and authors that you like. But anyway, we can do that another time.
We'll have time for that at the end of the episode.
Yeah. because I love people who have completely different perspectives from me, which is part of the fun of this. But anyway, I loved the book and I hated the book. The only reason I loved the book because it was 100% different than anything I've ever read in my life. And that, you know, for readers, that's, you know, for people that read a lot of books, like we all do, I think, that is rare, you know, and to, I like some repetition because I like how it really kind of brings the point home and makes sure you don't forget and really paints the picture. But he went, like, towards the end, I was like, okay, I got it, buddy. So it drove me a little bit crazy kind of towards the end. But in general, I just thought the story, which I love how the story within the story was, that was the same thing that Fuka Iri did for Komatsu and why he wanted to publish her story and why Tengo wanted to rewrite it was because her story was so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved the story of this. It was so, it was unexpected for me. It had loose ends that I didn't mind that it tied up, but then it tied up the ultimate one for me at the end, which I like, but I can totally get how that would kind of ruin it for some people. But for me personally, I loved that. But it was, I love to read a book that challenges me and surprises me, and it makes me think of things that I would have, you know, never thought of before. So I thought it was fantastic, but a bit of a challenge to get through. Some books that are a challenge for me to get through, like I just want to put them down, but I don't because I'm like, all right, I mean, I'm this far.
Dune.
Ugh, Dune. Dune, I just couldn't do it. I was like, life's too short. I can't do this. But this
oh,
one,
no,
I
I'm
kept...
just about to start reading Dune.
Oh, my
God. Dune is wonderful. You'll love it. It's just also
horrible.
It's a marathon, not a sprint.
But I couldn't. But this one, I could not. Like, I kept wanting to escape and go read it. Whereas Dune, I was like, okay, I'm gonna set aside some time this weekend. I'm gonna read. Like, felt like homework. Like this book, I couldn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So I agree, Julie. I agree with half of your sentiment. I too felt like it was a bit on the repetitious side. But at the same time, yes, it was extremely unique and much unlike anything that I'd read before. He'd had this way of taking disparate elements and writing three different stories at the same time, but still mashing it up and making it feel cohesive and believable, as opposed to, well, this is a fantasy novel, but it's also got guns in it. Like, that's your hook. Whereas this felt very, very genuine. My criticism and the thing that I just it didn't stop me from reading the novel, obviously, but the thing I couldn't get past was he's so descriptive about absolutely everything except sex. And he talks about sex an awful lot. I mean, the sex scenes are frequent and rather descriptive, but not in any kind of artistic way. The entire novel seems so over-sexualized. And for that reason, that's why I kind of assumed it was written by a woman. And I was kind of feeling like, well, it may be interpreted as exploitive. And in fact, I read some reviews on the internet from Reddit or Goodreads, and half of them feel like that it's fantastic, and the other half feel like it's horrible for that reason. Now, I don't really think it is, personally, because you do have a very strong female character, and you know, the male characters who are taking advantage of other people are, well, they get their comeuppance and or even find out that it wasn't exactly what it looked like. But I felt like as soon as people took their clothes off, the descriptions went almost like either like a cross between a biology textbook and a really cheap porno.
Ah,
that is such
so
an amazing
right.
point, Russ. Yes, you are so right. You know, like with Tengo and Fuka Iri and, you know, him, I like your chest size, but I'm really not attracted to you, or I'm not sexually attracted to you at all. Really, I'm not. But, like, I'm just going to keep looking at your chest all day. It just felt... you make such a good point. Honestly, I thought the exact same thing. And the way I sort of arranged it all in my head was the culture around sex in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know it, you know, through and through, and I have no in-depth knowledge of how this culture represents itself in Japan, but I know that, you know, I'm trying to gather my thoughts.
It's different than it here in those in the West.
Yeah,
at the very least.
It is, and it's somewhat, or could be somewhat offensive to women in the West, because it's very you know, it objectifies quite a lot. It uses the stereotypes of women are meant to be meek, and so when he speaks of Aomame and Ayumi and the Tengo's lover, I forget her name, you know, they are all very, very sexually aggressive, I guess, or mm-hmm. at least he's trying to represent them that way. And even Fuka Eri, you know, she takes the lead, you know, with Tengo, even though that's not exactly the same thing, but she does take the lead there. And then the men, you know, it's like he's trying too hard to say that, oh no, you know, I'm not objectifying women.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's trying too hard. Whereas that's all it's doing is objectifying women. At least it felt that way to me when I was reading it.
Oh, that's interesting. See, I thought it was very, I'm surprised that those reviews are there, because like the lead character is she's 100% in control of her sexual encounters. And so, I mean, I also understand that, you know, there are some characters that are not in this book, but I mean, so that's interesting. That surprises me that those reviews are there. But I guess I understand it. I do understand it. But so what I was saying is, I love a good sex scene, and so I really appreciate your comment of it's like there's so much lead up to, you know, a couple of these, you know, very provocative scenes, and then you're like, he just glosses over it, and you're like, wait a minute, you can't do that. It's very unsatisfying. And then what I was saying about Aomame is, or I'm saying that wrong. How did you say it in the audiobook?
Aomame.
Okay. It's interesting because I've been saying it wrong the entire time in my head reading the book. Anyway, but what I was saying is that she's so in control of her sexuality, and I really appreciated that. So that's why I was saying I was surprised at, you know, negative comments of how, you know, women were portrayed in this book, because she's so in control of her sexuality and her life and her actions and her partners and, mm-hmm. and everything. But I do think that was interesting how, you know, you so well said about, you know, he gave us so much lead up and then, you know, no satisfaction with the sex scenes. But I wonder, like you said, if that is, you know, part of that culture, and more of, is that part of more of the Japanese culture? There are more voyeurs. There are more, we'll go this far. We'll talk about someone's chest and how it might be beautiful. But when it comes to the actual private side behind closed doors, we're just not going to really go there. Mm. We're not going to go so deep.
And I wonder if that is something that also could have just been lost in translation.
Also,
yeah.
Also possible.
But it was so brief, and like he would spend pages and pages talking about, you know, Tengo's hands and
then, a trip to the grocery, you know, store,
right, and his meal.
Yeah,
which did I really enjoyed a lot of the food talk, and it made me.
it
I
did
love,
make me hungry.
It did make me hungry and appreciate how. What he calls a simple meal has like 25 different elements, which
exactly.
For me, you know, a simple meal is literally like a box of mac and cheese, mm-hmm. you know, like that's one element. Anyway, I digress.
Which when Ushikawa's on his stakeout and is in there eating canned peaches and
right.
and at one point he says, I just want to go to a restaurant and get a normal meal.
Right.
Why am I out here in the cold? And oh, I told you the narrator for that part of the story was very gruff. That's what he sounded like. I thought that narrator was spectacular, but
Oh, interesting. Oh, there were different narrators?
Yeah, so for each of the point of views, we had a different narrator, and the Ushikawa narrator was extraordinarily gruff.
I did try to listen to just a few words or just a little bit of Ushikawa's part so I could know what you were thinking, what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of Heath Ledger's rendition of The Joker.
Yes, it is very reminiscent of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
ooh, interesting.
That made me think of something else. We have these three characters who are the point of view characters. And these are the three who all look up at the sky and say, whoa, what's going on? Why are there two moons? Are there any other characters who acknowledge the moons or not at all? I know there's a point where Tango asks his friend, who is also his substitute teacher, if he noticed the moon, but I don't think we ever found out whether...
They did have the conversation, and he didn't see, or he didn't know what Tango was talking about.
Right, so
I think Tango did mention the two moons.
So was his friend's perspective, the moon looks normal, and then we don't know what normal
is? My understanding was that the friend did not notice the two moons. Aomame also had that conversation with Tamaru, I think, once or twice or two or three times.
Yep.
And he didn't seem to notice anything out of the ordinary there either. And did she mention it to Ayumi once? Did they talk about the moons at all?
Possibly.
No one else confirmed that there were two moons. And I am not sure about Fuka-eri. You would think she would see the two moons, but I don't think she ever mentioned.
Yeah, I don't think she did. Interesting.
I have a question.
Yes.
Was there any... I kept wanting to find significance through everything I was reading in this book. And was there any significance, besides the theme of duality, in the moons, the two moons, especially the second one, its shape, its color, you know, it's slightly smaller, it's a bit greenish, was there anything...
It was less. Very clearly, it was lesser.
The only other thing I noticed is that at one point in time, just before his death, Ushikawa is looking at his tongue, and he notices that there's some kind of a green, mossy substance growing on it.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, the second moon is always described as a mossy green.
Yeah, it's mossy green.
That's the only thing I noticed.
Yeah, I mean, because any time that they described the second moon, I did get this sort of icky feeling. I can't find a better word. Like I did with Ishikawa. And I just wondered why. I mean, I just wondered why, what we were supposed to draw from that.
So that's such an interesting theme, Tanya, because he made a point of that hard. And then you're right, relating it with him at the end. I wonder if there's some sort of significance there, because he talked about that a lot. There was a lot of repetition there.
Now, I had a question. Was there a significance to two things about Tango's older girlfriend, or possibly three things? Number one, she was always described as her older girlfriend. So what does that mean? Secondly, at some point she becomes, quote, irretrievably lost. So what does that mean? And then even later on, Tango is looking at a photo of what he assumes is his biological mother and says, she kind of looks like my older girlfriend. Was there a significance to those three facts?
Irretrievably lost older girlfriend was unanswered question number four in my notes. I have no idea what that whole thing was about. Why was she lost? Why was it the husband that finally contacts Tango and says she's never coming back? And I didn't understand why she was gone. But I never got any parallels to his mother.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once, when he had her try on the white slip and that went awry. Oh, sorry, actually, that wasn't the point. When he was smelling Fuka-eri's pajamas, she had worn his pajamas, and he said, why am I looking for the scent of my mother, or like, why am I looking for my mother in this teenage girl? Wouldn't it make more sense for me to look for my mother in my older girlfriend, perhaps?
Ooh,
you know,
yeah.
And he said he didn't, that he didn't see his mother in this older girlfriend. So I don't know if that was what led me to just never put it together that, you know, there is some sort of, not necessarily that the older girlfriend is his mother, but just anything. I didn't get any sense of relation between the older girlfriend and his mother.
Yeah.
I disagree. I definitely got a sense of relation, and I'm trying to remember when. Russ, you said it. There was some sort of either when he was at the Cat Town, and he was with, oh boy, I can't remember the nurse's name, but anyway,
yes.
But yeah, there was something, and either she, there was a picture and she looked like her, or there was a resemblance or something. But I think that I relate, it's interesting because, again, I didn't have any questions about what happened to the older girlfriend, because it was, for me, the exact same thing as, so what happened to Ayumi? So the little people were sending a message to Aomami, and so they took Ayumi, and same thing for Tengo.
Mm-hmm.
They were sending him a message, and so they took his older girlfriend. But I don't know. Maybe I was seeing that as too black and white because you guys are both questioning it. Interesting.
Well,
go ahead, Russ.
It does seem like there were a lot of either just, I don't know. I don't want to call them red herrings because it's not a murder mystery. It's not a detective novel. But it does seem like there were a lot of unexplored avenues that were meant to simply fill out the world, make it more real, almost kind of like A Song of Ice and Fire when you're introduced to characters who have these grand schemes that go absolutely nowhere, just to make you think about what could this mean, and does this have significance? And maybe it does, but it didn't come to fruition in this particular world, to make it more realistic. Tanya, what do you think?
Yeah, I when I ended the book, I was like, well, there should be probably like two more books to flesh out, because it seemed like, I think you made this point earlier, Russ, that it's like he had three books. He had a good way of bringing it into one, and you know, you kind of, it's a believable story that this is all happening in one novel, but it really did feel like just three completely, or you know, four or three, I don't know, completely separate books.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I wasn't convinced of, you know, significance or just the import that he maybe seemed to place on the influence of these little people, because at the end of the day, when, you know, the older girlfriend was irretrievably lost, I mean, it came to his mind once or twice, you know, but it's nothing that he dwelled on.
Yeah.
He really was able to just move on. Ayumi's death, you know, it didn't bring back the same sort of pain that you felt when Aomami talked about her old friend, forget her name, Tamari, nope, that's not it, friend who killed herself because of her husband and whatnot.
Yeah.
You felt pain when Aomami talked about this person. You felt that really changed the course of Aomami's life, and she basically, I think, became a killer because of this. But with Ayumi's death, you know, it was very bland. It was very stale. You know, it didn't seem to have any grave bearing on Aomami's actions or emotions, and neither did it with the older girlfriend, you know, leaving Tengo. And if we're setting up these little people as sort of the all-seeing, all-knowing beings in this novel, well, they're not, you know, really doing a good job of exerting their power, I don't think.
All right, well, I have one more question I wanted to ask, and that is the title of the book and the choice that the author used to set it in 1984 as opposed to 1985, 87, 79. He even makes mention specifically of Orwell and Orwell's dystopian nightmare and Big Brother. So what was the significance and the parallel between 1984 and 1Q84? I wasn't able to pick up on anything in particular. Did you guys notice anything outside of what was implicitly mentioned in the text?
I think he really wanted us to see the parallel when he would talk about Big Brother and how that and how Sakigake's influence and the leader, are sort of following that path, I guess. But I think he was trying too hard. I didn't see it. Didn't see it at all. I wanted to. I don't know. I think I wanted to be there with him, but I just wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have not read the book.
Ah, really?
And I'm like one of the only people on the planet who has not read the book. So I'm really sad. I was wishing when I read it that I had read the book so that I could draw those parallels, but I have not. So that's interesting that you guys say that.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually, this book was recommended to me. The first recommendation that I got was, it's kind of like a 1984. And that's what I was expecting throughout. I had read Orwell. I loved 1984. And I was like, okay, that's nice. You know, I'm expecting this very dystopian, hierarchical, organized world. Everybody has their place. And it definitely wasn't that. And when Murakami tried to get us to see Sakigake as that sort of structured, entity or body of people, it just didn't mesh. It really wasn't that. I mean, Sakigake people were free to roam. You know, they had some tenets that they had to abide by, but very few. It wasn't as hierarchical as that. I think the leader was the only one who was quote unquote Big Brother, but everybody else had were more or less on the same level. I don't know. Russ, do you disagree on that?
Frankly, I'm really not sure, and grasping at straws here, I'm just going to throw out the possibility that Big Brother is actually the little people and all of humanity doesn't even know that that's the case. And even Almame and Tengo escaping in the end might still not have escaped their clutches, what with this new air chrysalis being built. But admittedly, that is grasping at straws.
Yes.
All right. So
I think I'm doing the same.
Any other final thoughts on 1Q84?
Ushikawa, I'll just say, I would love to see an artist's rendering of him. Mm-hmm. Because the picture in my mind, I feel like I couldn't even complete that picture because it was so descriptive, and I have a picture of him in my mind, but I really would love to, it was still hard for me to complete that picture.
I imagined him looking a bit like Peter Lorre.
In Murakami's other book, the one that I just read, there was also a very slimy, icky, reptilian type person called Ushikawa. So I have a feeling that Ushikawa has some very significant something in Murakami's life. But
interesting. Like he met him. He was a figure in his life at some point.
This, and was he like, I want you
inspired
to know that this is what I think of you.
Interesting. And Komatsu, I loved him as a character as well. I mean, loved him and hated him, but loved him. Very interesting character.
Mm-hmm. I was just intrigued. Komatsu gets kidnapped for days, and he comes home and is very matter-of-fact about it. He says, yeah, right. They had me, and so I guess I'm going to do what they asked me to do now. So I pulled some strings. I made it work. Just, can you play along, please?
All right.
So that'll end our discussion on 1Q84, but we like to do a little wrap-up. Tell me, what else you've been reading. If you're going to join us for the next couple episodes, we've got The Martian, and we've got It, and Ready Player One are the next three on the docket. So if you'd care to join us for those, please do. Otherwise, any other recommendations you've got, what else you've got going on? Julie, let's start with you.
Well, after 1Q84, I needed a break. So I like to break up my reading. I like to throw a little smut in there. So I read the trilogy of, a friend recommended it to me, A Court of Thorns and Roses or something like that. Sarah J. Maas. So there's a trilogy, three books And it was crack. I plowed through their very, pretty long books. I read them in no time flat. I couldn't stop. It was just beautiful smut. I enjoyed them tremendously, even though there's many flaws, but it was a wonderful break. And just very treat. I thought they were a treat. So, but now I'm ready for, a little bit more meat. So I'm curious to know, but I am not going to read it. You know how I feel about this, Russell.
I do.
You know how I feel about
this. You're welcome to change your mind, but if you choose not to, I'll understand.
But I'm very curious to hear what you guys are reading.
Yes. Well, that's what we got in the next three, but we don't have February's book lined up yet, so shout if you have any recommendations.
Okay.
And Tanya, how about yourself?
So, same after 1Q84, I think I wanted something that I could just indulge myself in.
Yes.
And, Russ knows this, I think, at this point, but I am a massive Game of Thrones fan.
Yes,
and,
I am aware.
End of the show, I felt a little bit, I really wanted more, I guess. Have to wait about a year and a half for the next season. So I'd never read the books. I'd never read any of the books. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go ahead and do that. And I am currently already on book three. And I think it's been about a month since I've been reading. So they're very easy to get through. They diverge quite a bit from, book two from the TV series, but it's just wonderful to get back in that world. I love the way, George Martin creates his worlds, and you really feel like you're in it and part of it. And so I love that. As to the books on the docket, I have Ready Player One in my possession. And once I'm done with this book three of Game of Thrones, I will be reading Ready Player One. And I don't really have a recommendation of one book as such, but this was my first audiobook that I was listening to, 1Q84. And I'd always been resistant to audiobooks. And, when I read, I sort of imagine in my mind, and I have very vivid, imaginations of what I'm reading. And I thought that someone else's voice reading these things, I wouldn't imagine it quite as well. And I was right. 1Q84, I don't know that it ruined it for me. I think maybe it was never that elevated in my purview anyway, but listening to it was definitely a different feel than reading it. And what I realized through that, though, is that audiobooks, for me personally, are not good with fiction. But I was listening to the history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And I'm loving it. I am loving it in audiobook. I actually had the physical book, and I started reading it, and I was like, I can't do this. I cannot do this. So I returned it to the library, but I did find the audiobook, and it's just, I love it. It's everything to me right now when I'm driving. So
that's,
I guess,
so
my recommendation is
audiobooks
in fiction.
Yeah.
In nonfiction, rather. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of all mediums. I usually have an audiobook going and a paper book and an ebook going, which is probably not the best way to go about things. But that's very interesting.
I'm looking at The Omnivore's Dilemma. Have either of you read that?
Yes.
Oh, I have not, but I've heard about that. Beautiful.
The reason that I thought to bring it up is because you mentioned nonfiction in audiobook. The Omnivore's Dilemma is read by Scott Brick, and he is absolutely, bar none, my favorite audiobook narrator.
Awesome.
Also,
I did read that book,
go
but
ahead.
I might listen to it in audiobook.
Yeah, if you feel like rereading it, I strongly recommend checking it out because Scott Brick is fantastic. Rest in peace, Roy Dotrice, great British actor and the narrator of the audiobooks for A Song of Ice and Fire. Passed away, I think, last week.
Okay.
And then I have a recommendation, but I can't honestly recommend it if you follow me here. It's just after reading 1Q84 and getting this whole, wow, this is a mashup of a lot of different things and it's put together really well. It reminded me a lot of The Keep by Jennifer Egan. Neither of you guys read that, did you?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Yeah. So if you check out my Goodreads, I only gave it 2 stars. I honestly didn't like it all that much, but it is a very short book. It's only 240 pages, and it is unique in terms of books go. It has to do with a castle, and there's some supernatural elements within it. It's takes place in modern times, but there's some people who are going back to this castle that is kind of apocryphal, or what do you call it when it's a place out of time? No, I can't think of the term either. And then just like everybody else who's on the podcast, after reading 1Q84, I need a break, so I have been listening to podcasts and playing Dark Souls 2. And that's what I've been doing with my time since I finished the book.
Okay, so can you guys give me a synopsis of the, what was the next book on the docket other than it that
the next one is
Tanya
the...
said?
Okay, well, the very next one is going to be The Martian, which is, of course, the novel that the Matt Damon movie was based on. And the one after that is 1Q84, excuse me, we just read that one. Ready Player One.
What's that?
Really, I don't know. It was recommended to me by several people. As I said, we're really gunning to do this as a live show at MAGFest, which is a music game nerd fest in the Washington, D.C. area. So it was recommended to me by some people who also do podcasts. They found out what this podcast is all about, and they said, well, you ought to do a live show. And I said, well, we're going to do Dune. And he said, yeah, Dune would be good. Have you thought about what Ready Player One? And I thought, oh, yeah, that'd be good, too. So we did Dune, but we didn't do a live show. So I'm really going to try and do this one, Ready Player One, as a live show. Outside of the fact that I know that it is a sci-fi style book with a multitude of pop culture, nerd culture, sci-fi culture references within it, I know nothing about it.
Hmm.
And I am going in completely fresh. Oh, in addition to that, they are making a movie that is to be released in the first half of next year. I believe it's a Spielberg production. Although now I'm going to have to look that up.
I might give that a shot.
Yeah, I mean, to take a look and see if it's something that might be in your bailiwick.
Yeah, I will, definitely. I'm ready for something a little different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is interesting. I'm looking it up on IMDb. It is Steven Spielberg. But the very first thing I'm seeing is... a screenshot from the trailer, and there's the Iron Giant standing right there. And have you guys ever seen that movie, The Iron Giant?
Yes.
Brilliant movie. Love that movie.
Loved it.
That's my top 5 favorite kids movies of all time.
Oh, loved it. There it is.
All right. Any other thoughts before we close out?
Nope.
All right. Thank you guys very much. This has been a pleasure.
Agreed. Yes. Thank you, guys.
A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. A Novel Podcast at gmail.com or at A Novel Podcast. Look forward to hearing from you.